Welcome to PB Link Stories. We explore the stories and uncover the business secrets of some of Britain's most successful entrepreneurs.
My name is Bill Mayer of PrecisionPresentation.com. Today, I'm interviewing Michael Dembinski, Senior Advisor to the BPCC, the British Polish Chamber of Commerce, an expert on Poland's responses to the 2008 financial crisis, Brexit, and the COVID pandemic. He is a son of Bohdan Dembinski, hero of the 63-day 1944 Warsaw Uprising. Bohdan survived the uprising and the war, but his brother Józef, Michael's uncle, sadly died fighting in the uprising and is buried in Warsaw. In 2016, after the death of his wife, Bohdan returned every year to Warsaw from Ealing, where he lived, to visit his brother's grave on the anniversary of the start of the Warsaw Uprising, August the 1st. Crowds would gather to wait for Bohdan, the war hero, queuing up to meet him and interview him. Bohdan Dembinski died on the 29th of October 2019 in Ealing, London. Michael, as we said, is his proud son. Michael, welcome to PB Link Stories.
Hello there, Bill.
Hi. Michael, your father was a war hero, highly regarded in Poland and beyond. What do you say to those who claim the uprising was a doomed and foolish endeavour?
Well, I just, I have no view other than what my father has told me and his experience, firstly, during the Nazi invasion of Poland in September 1939, the years of occupation, the things that he witnessed there, the arbitrary arrests, the roundups, and the street executions. He took me one day, we were along Nowy Świat, main street in Warsaw, and he showed me a spot where he was standing on the steps of church, Świętego Jakuba, and he was looking down Nowy Świat and saw a truckload of Polish prisoners, young men mainly. Truck came to a stop. They were all made to get out of the truck, and they were just machine gunned to death, just a mass execution. One of many that happened. That was one that my father happened to see. So the way he explains it to me was that it wasn't a calculated decision about whether the Soviets will come, whether the allies, Western allies, will support us with parachute drops or whatever. It was a simple act of revenge. I think really my father's only sort of moments of real heroism was when there was the collapse of the attack by his unit, Battalion Odvet. Odvet means revenge. Against the SS and Gestapo barracks in Kolonia Staszica, just south of the city centre. Their battalion, essentially, the problem was that they didn't have any weapons. They had literally a handful of pistols and a handful of Molotov cocktails. When the order was given to start, my father and another 20 guys were in a house on Ulica Filtrowa, but further down, right down the eastern end of that street. And they were just waiting for someone. They were in a first floor room, waiting for the order and waiting for weapons. None of these came. And some of them took a decision, well, that's it. There's no point carrying on. Let's just go back. You know, leave Warsaw, go to the village, seek safety, security. But my father was one of a handful who decided that they're going to cross the field, Pole Mokotowskie, the now a park. At the time, it was a huge cabbage patch, to get across to the barricades on the other side, where another unit, Battalion Golski, was fighting the Germans there. Now, Battalion Golski was much better equipped. They had anti-tank weapons, and the Germans were rather afraid of that particular unit. But my father managed to make it through. He was saying that they were doing this crossing at night, treading on cabbages, very noisy. There's silence, just the occasional sort of shots of gunfire in the city centre. But, you know, every time he trod on a cabbage, he could be heard by the Germans, and a burst of machine gun fire sweeping across the top of the cabbage field. They were pressed down to the ground. But they managed to get across. So my father, you know, late in life, said that he had a very lucky life. But he didn't really consider himself a hero. He didn't. The Battalion Golski, they managed to hold the line that the barricades on one side. There was the Politechnika, the Warsaw Technical University, on one side of Ulica Narkowskiego. On the other side, my father and his unit were holding that line, and that line was never broken. They held that line right up to the 63rd day until capitulation. You know, he said that was more like accident than heroism, The Germans were worried that Golski was still a particularly effective unit. They'd knocked out several German tanks. The German unit facing them were not a particularly elite unit, so they didn't want to get engaged. Anyway, that's how my father tells it. So he spent, apart from the early days, he spent all of his time in that area around the Politechnika, the Warsaw Technical University.
Amazing stuff. Michael, you have reason to be incredibly proud of your parents. I've just heard a little bit about your father. Your mother went through hell in a Soviet gulag on the journey there in cattle trucks. People just rounded up from Eastern Poland, put in cattle trucks, sent to the Arctic Circle. She survived the gulag. She survived the journey then to the Middle East. And from there, your mother and your father went their separate ways and met in England. Now, you yourself say that you were born Polish in the UK. How has your upbringing shaped you and your identity?
It's a very interesting question, because my brother had exactly the same upbringing. He married an English girl and lives in England. I happened to, we both went to Saturday Polish school. I went right through until A-level. So that's from age 5 until 18, every single Saturday during term time, when my friends were, you know, either playing football or, you know, ABC Minors cinema, going shopping or whatever, I'd be there learning about Polish history, geography, literature, language, obviously. Very useful skills, as it happened. Saturday afternoons as Polish scouts, which is pretty much a very sort of paramilitary experience. You know, many of the sort of the older guys who were running it were veterans of the Second World War. I'd fought at Monte Cassino, or fought with the alongside the Eighth Army in North Africa. You know, the drill was pretty paramilitary. A lot of it, you know, field craft. Creeping around in parks after dark. It's great fun, actually. I really enjoyed it. I was there in the scouts from the age of about 6 or 7 of the Cub Scouts, right through to about 16 or so of the Venture Scouts. I really enjoyed that. It was good fun. Then, you know, there was Polish church on Sunday. There was Polish youth club by the church. Polish student and graduate association. So, you know, went sort of fairly seamlessly through that upbringing. And, you know, interestingly enough, my wife, who was born in Manchester, both of her parents are also from Poland. So my father-in-law fought with the Polish Navy. He was on the ORP Błyskawica, the destroyer. He was the artillery officer on that. And my mother-in-law was the courier for in Home Army, so also fought in the Warsaw uprising. So my wife has a very similar background in terms of Polish Saturday School, Polish Girl Guides, church and associations. But again, her sister happened to meet an American guy, and they just live in America. Children don't speak Polish. Whereas we took a decision in 1997, when the children were still young, to move to Poland. Interestingly, again, daughter has completed her studies here and is living and working in between Warsaw and Łódź, whereas our son has decided that he wants to return to the UK. So, you know, that Polishness seems to be sort of every other person. So there's an element of nature and an element of nurture.
Yeah, that's interesting, the nature of Polishness versus Britishness and what wins out. Michael, we mentioned that you're senior advisor to the BPCC. Can you tell us a bit about the work of that organisation, please?
Well, the BPCC is next year is going to be 30 years old. It was an organisation set up to support British investors as they moved into the Polish market shortly after the political and economic transformation at the beginning of the 1990s. So there was a lot of need at the time for support as these British companies came in. The whole infrastructure, you know, the lawyers, the accountants, the recruitment companies, the marketing consultants. There was so much that was needed at the time, and also, you know, that element of lobbying, getting the message across about the importance of foreign direct investment to the Polish economy in terms of creating jobs, in terms of spreading best practice and know-how. So, still, you know, although we consider ourselves to be a bilateral chamber, the bulk of our work really is still done around those British investors in Poland. Although the situation is definitely shifting, we're now seeing more and more Polish companies that are interested in investing in the UK. Some notable examples here are companies like Telefonica Cable that invested in a British company called JDR Cables, 2016, the largest manufacturer of those big thick cables that go under water between wind turbine farms offshore and the grid onshore. The other examples are the company LPP, known by its brand name Reserved as one of Poland's largest clothing retailers. They have a flagship store on Oxford Street in London. Then there's plenty of food. The UK, despite Brexit, remains Poland's number two export market for food. So although the UK has lost out in importance because of Brexit, it's now fallen to fourth place from second place. The food export is still holding up strong. Then you've got companies like Inglot, Dr. Irena Eris in the world of cosmetics, health and beauty. You have companies, furniture. Furniture is a massive area of export from Poland to the UK. But again, lots of this is branded IKEA, for example, or, you know, posh German brands, but you know, it's actually made in Poland. So one of the things that we're doing, working with Polish exporters to help them through all the new red tape, we have a lot of companies who are helping out around Brexit, whether they are, you know, tax accountants who can sort out all your customs duties and VAT issues, whether it's someone to help out with transit guarantees, all the logistics things, you know, customs agents. There's a vast amount of new work that needs to be done if you're continuing to trade between Poland and the UK. And we have many members who can help out in that area.
Excellent. Now, Poland emerged stronger and was affected less than most Western economies, most EU economies, from the global financial crash of 2008. it's coping better economically with the COVID pandemic as well. Now, you've spoken before about the distinctive character of the Polish people as being partly due to the location of the country, to the west of Eastern Europe and to the east of Western Europe. Geography, history, genetics, what gives Poland the edge?
One of my pet theories is about the Industrial Revolution. Britain had the Industrial Revolution towards the end of the 18th century. So you have in the UK families where for 10 generations, people have worked in the factory, in the mills. They've been detached from the land for a long, long time. And my thinking is that if you're a smallholder, if you're a peasant farmer, your obligation to your family to feed them, you have to work hard. A couple of years ago, I was driving to a conference in the south of Poland. It was minus 26 outside on the car thermometer. I was driving along between Konstancin and Sandomierz, and I saw by the side of the road there was an old woman walking, leaving a forest, and on her bag a sack of firewood. And she was walking across this field towards a little cottage. And it occurred to me at that moment that at minus 26 degrees centigrade, there's no such word as manana. You either collect that firewood or you freeze to death. Farmers, they plow, they harvest, they sell their crop. And if they don't do that, their family hasn't got what to eat. I remember shortly after we moved to Poland, I went for a long country walk with our children, and we saw this farmyard, and on the farm, in the middle of the farmyard, was a big table, and on that table was a huge pig lying dead. His throat had been slit, and under the throat, under the table, was this bucket, and it's bleeding into the bucket. And my children were looking at this transfixed, you know, what's going on here? And I was explaining that, you know, the blood, everything, every part of this pig has a value. You make kaszanka, black pudding from the pig's blood by adding oats and barley and seasoning. And the following day at work, I mentioned this to my colleagues, Beata and Dorota. I said, you know, we saw this scene yesterday, and, you know, both of them said, oh, I remember my granddad used to do this, you know. And then it struck me, you know, most Poles are just two generations removed from the land, not 10 generations removed from the land.
Yep.
And I would argue that early industrialization has created a sense of learned dependency that, as long as you come in to work at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning and you work your 40-hour week and you leave on a Friday, you'll get paid. You get your weekly wage. And it was like that for many generations in the UK until two things started happening, globalization and IT. They both happened at about the same time. And those factories at the end of the street, you know, I went to a state primary school in West London. Of the 36 children in my class, only three of us passed the 11 plus and got into a grammar school. The rest were condemned to secondary modern education, which was tailored for the needs of the factory down the end of the road. Okay. And then that factory closed. And, you know, I'd argue that, you know, a lot of Britain's problems stem from that. The simultaneous appearance of the Far East as a manufacturing base for the world's production and IT cutting out a lot of those manual jobs, making incredible leaps forward in terms of efficiency and productivity. And Poland is still at a relatively early stage here compared to the UK. I think a lot of this is also, you know, sort of stepping out of communism, that when friends of mine, when their parents in the UK, when their parents died, they'd leave them a house worth £1 million. You know? When my friends in Poland, when their parents died, they'd leave them enough money to buy a new laptop. So for, you know, for my generation, that difference in inherited wealth or potentially inheritable wealth has made a big difference. Because if you were, my age, but growing up in Poland, and all of a sudden it's 1990, communism has fallen, you're in your late 20s, early 30s, now is the time that you either join the rat race, you get that job in the Western corporation, or you set up your own business and you work your fingers to the bone, because you've got nothing to fall back on, you've got everything to play for, you've got the West to catch up with, you want all of these goodies that the West has enjoyed, you want a flash car, you want a nice big house, you want exotic holidays, you want all of these wonderful clothes and consumer durables. And I would argue that that has really been the driver for the last 30 years. I mean, it's an important generational shift there as well. And looking back at 30 years, say, if you look at other economies, France talks about la glorieuse trente, the 30 years that they had of uninterrupted growth from the end of the 1940s to the end of the 1970s, when there was this incredibly steep rise in ordinary people's standards of living. That's very much what we are seeing here in Poland. But then look at Japan. 1945, Japan was a nuclear waste ground. It was bombed to pieces by the US Air Force. By 1990, it was, competing there with the United States as, one of the wealthiest nations on earth in terms of GDP per capita. And then all of a sudden, that Japanese drive just petered out. And now you think about your sort of stereotype of a Japanese person is, a young man in his 30s who lives at home with his parents reading manga comics and not really having the sort of the drive to get on in life, mm-hmm. And yet that post-war generation that created an incredible economy through just sheer hard work, but they burnt themselves out, and another generation came along and said, well, we don't want to follow in the footsteps of our parents. We don't want to burn ourselves out. Life is too precious and beautiful. Let's sniff the flowers and discuss poetry.
Do it and get away with it, go for it.
Poland is not yet in the flower sniffing and poetry discussion stage, but there will come a time, and it's a natural part of human evolution, of human progress, that one generation can step back and say, well, we no longer have to work as hard as our parents. But I don't think we're there yet.
Thanks very much, Michael. Now we come to the last question, the question that we ask everybody on PB Link Stories. What is the secret of business?
I think the secret of business is not to be greedy. It's not to be too pushy. It's not to sell things to people that they don't need and can't afford. I think part of the biggest problem facing mankind, which is climate change, part of it is the fact that we've got nearly 8 billion people on this planet, of whom 2 billion are, well off. And it's those 2 billion who say, I want a bigger car. I want an even more exotic holiday. And they are being pandered to by businesses who can see that, here's a bunch of suckers. We can sell them a V8 powered SUV that weighs 2.5 tons just to drag themselves into the city centre and back home into the supermarket. They don't need that car, but that car is causing a vast amount of harm to the planet. And I think in general, there's so much, people do have needs. People have needs that businesses genuinely do cater for. But when those needs, when you tip over the barrier between a need and a want, when you tip the barrier between living comfortably, which everyone has a right to living comfortably, not to live in discomfort, but then living in luxury. And, much of that is created by businesses' short-term desire for gain. I think, you know, greed and short-termism are, you know, a bad thing. Now, if so, the secret of success in business is listening, genuinely wanting to know what your customer really wants, what they really need, what their need is. Everyone has needs. Everyone has things that they need solving, that there is a potential solution to people, be it in manufactured products or in services. We need things. And the secret of success in business is that person who listens, who says, right, okay, I can see that there is a problem here. Let's see if we can solve it. And I think that part of the huge advance that we've seen in the world, in the global economy, really driven by IT, has been around this. It's been new solutions to genuine human problems. I mean, much of this now driven by, you know, apps. And it's just amazing what you can get from a telephone loaded with apps. It's you know, sort of a life enhancing thing. And it's those businesses that you know, had the vision to create this whole infrastructure that have immensely helped society. But it is, you know, coming back to I think that, you know, that key thing is to understand your client, understand what they really need, and not just make a fast buck from them, but to, you know, engage in a long-term, lifelong relationship with your client based on shared values, shared, you know, shared brands. I mean, when I think about the things around, here is one. Here's a very good example. This is my Nikon lens that I bought back in the 1980s, and I still use Nikon. My cameras are Nikon cameras. I love the brand. I feel that Nikon is a brand that understands me and my requirements in photography. Levi's jeans. I only wear Levi's jeans. I don't wear jeans by anybody else. And it's a lifelong thing that if you understand and prepared to listen to your client, your customer, you build that lifelong value.
Fantastic. Don't be greedy. Listen and have vision, and have vision to actually meet the needs of your customers, and have a long-term vision. Build relationships with your customers. And from that, of course, comes quality. If you want a long-term relationship with your customers, then you need to provide quality, because otherwise they're going to leave you.
Absolutely.
Words to live by, certainly words to run your business by. Michael, thanks very much for everything you've told us today.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. It's a real pleasure. Real pleasure to have a chat like this. So, anytime you want to do another one, always up for it.
Fantastic. And to our listeners, be sure to subscribe to PB Link Stories to listen as we hunt down inspiring entrepreneurs to find out the secret of business.
Join us at our next event and engage with the business community.